Hi, my name is Luama and I am a Global Health PhD student at McMaster University. Today, I am honored to be your host for the Global Health Collective podcast. In this episode, we are going to be talking to the wonderful Dr. Alexandra Martin-Yuk, who is a professor of epidemiology in the Faculty of Medicine and Health, School of Public Health at the University of Sydney. She is also an honorary senior research fellow at the George Institute for Global Health. Additionally, she is an adjunct professor in epidemiology at the University of Toronto. She holds an MSc in Community Health and Epidemiology and a PhD in Epidemiology and Biostatistics from Canada. Her expertise is in epidemiology, health services research, and implementation science in complex and fragile settings. Her work focuses on child health, neurological and mental health, health systems, and services research, epidemiology, and knowledge translation. Her work is committed to improving the health of individuals living in disadvantaged settings locally and globally. She has sat on the Australian National Mental Health Commission Technical Advisory Group for Children and Youth, among various other notable advisory boards. A warm welcome to you, and incredibly excited for this rich conversation. Our first question for you today is, can you speak to a little bit about what was the pathway that led you to where you are today as a health systems and services researcher, and what initially drew you into the expansive field of global health?
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear people's backgrounds, isn't it? So I'll start with, so I'm Canadian. And now also Australian citizen. And my dad has Ukrainian heritage. And my mom was adopted with unknown heritage. And I grew up in a family with six children, and I'm in the middle. And we've all gone on to do different things. But that's a bit, I guess, important because it makes us who we are. And a lot of the time that I grew up was on the island off of Vancouver, which wasn't very populated back then. So I grew up with a lot of nature and then moved to Ottawa, the capital city of Canada, where I started to get a lot more understanding about politics and the role that Canada played in the world and so on. So I was initially drawn into global health because I had an interest to gain skills so that I could contribute to improving the health of a large number of children and families. So part of that came because I started working with kids in the children's hospital in Canada. And that was my first kind of experience working, I guess, and working in a hospital. And I saw that we had a great health system in Canada. It was available to all. You know, money couldn't buy you necessarily a bump up in the waiting list. Just everybody got the same opportunity for health, or so it looked, I suppose. It is probably not exactly the case in real life. But I saw that, and I worked in pediatric oncology and childhood cancer for about somewhere between 7 and 10 years. And that was working with a non-governmental organization in partnership with the hospital. And so that was also my deep understanding into the role of NGOs in health. And then while I was doing that, I started doing some work both in Indigenous Canadian communities in Northern Ontario and Northern Canada, as well as in Central America. So I did a master's degree because I heard the title Community Health and Epidemiology, and I like the idea of community health. I believed in sort of a collective process towards health, and I believe that where we live and where we grow up supports our well-being and our health. And so anyway, I didn't really know what epidemiology was, but I enrolled in this degree because it was called Community Health and Epidemiology. And during that degree, I had an opportunity to do some of my master's degree in Central America. And I was working still at the children's hospitals in Canada, two different children's hospitals. So I started to see that we had great differences in our opportunities for health and in our health systems. And my sisters at the time, so I have older sisters and I have younger siblings as well. Well, my sisters were going through clinical medicine. And I thought, oh, no, maybe I'd like to be a clinical doctor. And I still find that a very interesting field. But I came to understand that the focus there is on supporting the individual patient in front of you mostly. And the focus is rightfully there to advocate for that individual in front of you. And I do think that's very important, and we need people in our system like that. But I grew very interested in potentially supporting improved, I guess, systems or actions that would affect the health of many, many people at once. And so that was where I started to really understand that community health and epidemiology was one potential avenue towards that. And I really, I guess, through my experiences of working with children and families, this was during the initial years of HIV. So this is like the mid-90s. When I was working in actually in schools in Central America, Honduras, Belize, Guatemala, I had a great opportunity to be with a lot of young students and teachers. And it was fabulous because I got to know the value of chatting with real people, you know, on the grassroots level, understanding what people wanted, needed, where the gaps were. And I got really interested in gaps, I guess, that exist where we have evidence in the world, but it's not reaching all people. And so I guess so far in my career, I hope I still have a lot of my career ahead of me, but so far in my career, I've really focused on what I call in words, closing treatment or prevention gaps. So where there is already evidence, but it's not reaching all individuals who need that evidence. That's broadly, I guess, what led me into global health.
That's such a great answer, especially I think one thing that you point out is the lived experience and intersecting identities and how they shape an individual or a collective's, a society's ability to access or be barred from healthcare services. And I'm really glad that you brought that up because it's such a critical factor that I think that is taking more prevalence in the kinds of conversations that we're having today. But and we're going to talk about the biomedicalization of knowledge a little later. But I think that having people with lived experience, because they're experiencing the gaps, can more easily point out the gaps to you than more so like health practitioners who are embedded in a system that that they don't, they themselves are not experiencing the inequalities of, right? So thank you so much for your answer. And so we're just wondering, what does a typical day look like for you in your life with your various expertise and various interests too, right? So what does that look like?
Yeah, and I guess I will start like when you say various interests, I think you're very right. And I think it's interesting that especially in academia, we're taught, or the system tells us, I'll say that, to focus, to go deep. And so one, I guess the positive framing of it would be to go deep into a topic. And the negative framing of it would be to go siloed into a topic. Mm-hmm. And it's not me who I am. It's not what I'm interested in, and it's not the way I believe the world works. So I've often found myself also in a juncture that I find difficult because I'm in academia that needs me to work in a silo, but I believe in trying to understand and work in complexity, improve integration, believe in holistic thinking. And so in that sense, that's why I really align to Indigenous people's thinking, which is not always, because we have many different kinds of Indigenous people in the world, but is often quite holistic in its thinking. And anyway, I say that in advance because people often say to me, oh, your day is one, you could say positively eclectic and lovely. And some people just say, you're all over the place. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. I don't see the connection. And I find that quite interesting. And I've sat on interview panels where I'm being interviewed and the panel will say, well, you know, you look like you're all over the place. And I'll say, but yet society believes in some structures which draw links across. So for instance, you know, WHO and Canada, if you're coming from a Canadian perspective, believe in the value of primary care, which I strongly believe in as well, and the value that has for health systems. Well, it's a naturally all-encompassing sort of breadth of experience. And so anyway, that's my lens, I guess, on epidemiology, global health, is trying to come at it with a complexity lens, actually, and try and keep away from chaos.
That's so hard. Yeah, exactly. But oh, chaos is exactly the moment that we're embedded in. But with that said, I think that's why we need to acknowledge the complexity of the social systems that we're living in and the various factors that are contributing to inequities and health on a local scale, but also on a global scale. And I think that we should obviously be looking at Indigenous practitioners and lived experiences for the more expansive understanding of our just on one hand, our level of interconnectedness, in that my health depends on your health. So if we're living in a system that's inherently unequal, then nobody's going to achieve good health, right? Like, I think I'm failing to remember his name, but he says it is no good measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. So if we're looking at the level of interconnectedness within the system, then it is really about holistic perspectives that take into account all the different factors that add to health, rather than these siloed approaches that I think we sometimes have that really stem from the way that academia is constructed. And I could talk about that expansively, but in my second question for you is that you've previously worked as a consultant for AusAid, the AusAid Knowledge Hub in Sydney, which is a hub that aims to provide improved health knowledge and expertise to inform policy dialogue. So can you share what being a consultant entailed and what knowledge translation, especially in those spaces, looks like, and why it is so key in developing comprehensive and more holistic health policies? And I think you've touched on different factors pertaining to that in your previous answers.
Yeah, thank you. It's so interesting. And I realize, obviously, I didn't really answer well the previous question, which was, what does a day look like? But to summarize that, to say eclectic, including, you know, higher level meetings, I suppose, with funders, as well as sort of everyday grassroots stuff. And being a mother as well. I have three young children, mm-hmm. and a husband, which is important to ensuring they have good health and
yes,
and go on to have a good life themselves and contribute to the world. So on to the consultancy kind of question. So so AusAid is like USAID or CEDA in Canada, or other aid kind of programs. It's a governmental fund, think tank sort of thing. And I guess I want to break down one aspect, which is, you know, when I was growing up, when I heard the word consultant or consultancy, mm-hmm. I had all kinds of views around what that was. It sounded fancy. It sounded for maybe only people who knew what they were doing. And then when I got up into academia, it was also kind of a dirty word. You are a consultant, i.e. you were there just for the money. You weren't really driving the idea. You were now tied. You were not independent. And so I put those things there because I think that's really important to mention early. Where I currently sit with my understanding myself is there's great value in all kinds of ways of improving our world, right? And consultancy is one way. So as an academic, we often do academic-driven work where we have ideas. Hopefully that's with end users, where we co-design or co-think what the needs are, and then we seek money or change or knowledge together to make improvement in life or whatever. Whereas consultancy often is a group. It could be industry, like so commercial, it could be government, it could be NGO, who have funds or resources and an idea usually, and an end product in mind, or an end goal mm-hmm. in mind, or an impact in mind. And they seek somebody who has the skill set to carry over or carry on that work. So anyway, my work with AusAid was, and other consultancy work, it was quite interesting and useful. I think the good thing about consultancy is the group coming to you already knows what they're seeking to some extent. There is often a pathway to translation already set up, because the group who's asking for the skills is ready to implement the knowledge or the change once the knowledge has been gathered or analyzed or decided upon, or whatever the case might be. So that's great, because sometimes in academia, we have an idea, we run with it together with hopefully end users, community, but then we try to push it out almost upon systems that never asked for this new knowledge. And so that's a harder gig. You try to translate something where people didn't even know there was the question, and maybe the system isn't there to translate it. And so it's just harder work. Whereas this consultancy is, it can more often lead to translation, which is great. But sometimes also the question's already set in a frame that you might not agree to. And so you, I guess joining a consultancy, you have to be okay with knowing what is the brief. Either it aligns with the values that you want to work with already, or you can see that there's an opportunity to alter the brief together with the, you know, the payer, whoever's looking for the consultant, and the team and the grassroots side, you know, whoever it is, it's going to be the end impact group. So, yeah, so in the end, I think also what happens in consultancy, but it happens also in other kinds of work, is often you can gather great knowledge, make decisions, understand a better way forward. And sometimes that's taken up and sometimes it's not. And you got to just come to the reality that that can also occur. And certainly that could occur in groups like, say, an AusAid knowledge hub, where mm-hmm. government might change. You know, one government asks you to do the work, the work's ongoing, and then the government changes and that work never happens. Or for instance, some of the work we were doing was with Papua New Guinea, and some of their policies or programs changed, so their desires changed, or the people in power to who originally asked for the work, now they weren't necessarily interested in it. But one thing I did like about it was highly connected to people in Papua New Guinea. So, you know, university, government, and NGOs, as well as people in Australia who had power to make change, whether they rightly or wrongly held that power, that's another point, but they had power to make change. I'll stop there. It's a long story.
No, I really appreciate it too, just because so I am thinking about like global health consultancy and global health communications in my own journey. So I really appreciate hearing insight into the world of consultancy. I really appreciate how you defined it in two ways. And it's really about, does it align with your value and also values, and as well as the people that are embedded in the system, whether they're interested in change, and also how are you engaging the local populations that you aim to help in what you framed as being co-design, because that's so critical, as if people do not want that, you can't force that onto people, because there just has to be an openness, and an openness both on the end of the consult the person consulting, the way that they perceive an issue to be might not be how the local population perceives it to be, then there needs to be an openness and dialogue in terms of how do we merge then these two different understandings. Or it's not even merging. Sometimes it's really having the humility of, you know, the consultant to say, I actually don't know what's going on. How about, you know, lived experience is a form of expertise. So how about you engage the actual experts who are located within that social context, and them be the people that explain to you what's happening. And I'm interested in like consultancy in that my aim is sort of to bring in like contexts such as history that are sometimes shied away from, where when we're talking about history, entangled histories of violence and interlocking systems of oppression. It's really having people who have lived through the experiences of being on the receiving ends of inequality and having them define certain issues, right? Because it really shapes what initiatives you come up with. So I see myself in that role as pointing out, and it's not, I don't necessarily see it as pointing out things that other people haven't pointed out before, because I think I come from a long legacy of human beings who are demanding justice and demanding to be seen. But it's really trying to penetrate those spaces and with more bravado and gusto and to keep repeating the same kinds of calls for action, right, with in an unwavering manner. So I really appreciate your answer, because I think that it just highlighted to me how expansive consultancy could be, and really the importance of being aligned with your values and having that collective vision of what change looks like. Because if you don't have that collective imagining, then you're not walking on the same path with the people that you aim to be helping or you say that you're helping. And I'm interested to know in your own work, especially in working in policy, how do you navigate, or how did you navigate competing interests in your line of work, especially when we know that knowledge can become highly politicized, right? And vested interests can get in the way of forming effective policies that can greatly improve our health systems.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I come across that quite a lot. And the hierarchies of power and who gets to say what is, and these days, who gets to say what is evidence? In the past, like not so far away, along, 10 years ago, even in medicine and health, anyway, we had the hierarchy of evidence, which, still exists. But really, whose hierarchy is that? What question is being answered by that hierarchy? And it's everywhere. So even just within healthcare, I'll often do, a project that, even let's say it's a guideline for a particular health condition, or different health workers are seen in different power lights. And when they, if a different health cadre creates evidence, it can be seen with a different lens than another cadre that creates evidence. And I have needed to lead teams and, advise on outcomes with these kinds of things. And just gosh, I just think these things are just unbelievably nuanced and just take a lot of gentle conversation, trying to come to a shared outcome of interest, a shared end place. And almost to understand in each, I think you almost have to talk about each very specific project, don't you, or each specific scenario and how it has come around or not, for instance. So in one of my recent projects, which I will try and talk in generalities because some of it's confidential, obviously, but there was some evidence that's been written down. It was seen as stronger, but then there's some new evidence that's coming, which is much more grassroots. There's a movement behind it, but it hadn't been published in the same way that this history of other evidence, and yet our grassroots voices, the people who were experiencing the thing we wanted to work on said that both kinds of evidence were equally valuable to them. They both mattered. And it was quite obvious that both mattered, and even the health workers were uncertain. Some were divided, some were okay with both at the end. And then we had to pitch this to government, you know, and so they would say, look, you know, we want you to uptake both kinds of evidence, but really, you know, government would typically more often like this long-standing evidence that we're used to, and it's in a hierarchy that is agreed by certain, you know, people types or groups. Right. And so in the end, we just called the other body of evidence as contemporary evidence. You know, where new innovations were arising, because this is kind of the terminology that we felt government would be open to hearing, because we knew they were open to innovation, and that, you know, innovation is so new, you might not have a deep history of, you know, a written, I guess, whatever, written trail. And it was a way of giving, I guess, power and voice to groups, people, sectors that don't typically otherwise. And most people, after many conversations, which were way beyond the intended project plan, but I think through many conversations, the group mostly was happy with the end outcome. Mm-hmm. We had some outliers on all sides that were not, but there was a lot of movement and change, I think, by a lot of people. Yeah, but it's quite vague, so maybe I'll stop.
I think it's a good answer, just because, as well as that, when we speak about lived experience and lived experience experts, especially in spaces of policy or academia, that's often dismissed as being quasi-intellectual, or it not being in a quote-unquote objective form of knowledge production that can be validated. And I think that you speak to the importance of equating both qualitative research methodologies as well as quantitative, right, as being of equal merit. But we know that existing in academia and policy making, that one is more biased than the other, and we love more numerical data outcomes rather than verbal anecdotes of people's experiences of the world. So I think that you're bringing up a very important question that you actually answered my other question, which is really about the ideas of objectivity in knowledge production and how it can be so alienating, especially for predominantly racialized communities, because a lot of their communicating of their experiences is through anecdotes, and that should be a valid form of evidence in terms of critiquing certain systems. But we have, as you phrased it, hierarchies of evidence that do more harm than good, or catalyze social cohesion, because they're so alienating again, which I think that can be a good segue for to my other question in terms of hierarchies of evidence, but also hierarchies of knowledge. But, you know, as we know, the centers of global health knowledge production are primarily located in Western countries. What is also known as the ideological boundaries of the global north. And I think that you've spoken to some impacts of that, but what impacts do you think that this has in terms of knowledge translation, global health governance, and international health policy making?
Yeah, great question. And just everything that you're saying, I just nodding vigorously here. Just, you know, as a bit of background to me, because I trained as an epidemiologist, it's a very quantitative method. I studied cluster randomized control trials. I'm very interested in that as a method, use that quite a lot. It has a lot of great merit. I mean, I have nothing against any quantitative method either. I use them regularly, But I really consider myself now a mixed methods person, because it really matters what's the question and what's the aim. And then the method becomes more clear. And usually a multitude of methods are needed. There are really windows or lenses upon a topic upon which we are trying to understand, grapple with, move forward together. And there's never just one lens to look through these. So anyway, so that's interesting. And then just to this global north, which is funny to say always because I'm in Australia and it's so far south, but it's really in the north. we shall say. But I completely agree. And you hear people saying things like, oh, why is there no conversation about this? We'll just say that very generalistically. Mm-hmm. But it's like, okay, what do you mean by why is there no conversation about this? When people say that sentence, they mean, why are the European journals of medicine not discussing in their essays about such and such? But actually, if you go to a Mandarin published journal or Global South, there's a lot of conversation. I mean, there's an entire other space that, unfortunately, I'll say they, because I'm in the global north, I'm born in the global mm-hmm. north, and I'm really working still in that sector because I'm in Australia. I'll keep saying the global south because I know that's how Canada phrases it, but we mm-hmm. ask the global south, listen to our conversations, but forever ignore or don't even realize there's a massive conversation happening that we don't partake in. So I think it's very refreshing that tiny bits of conversation are happening. Mm-hmm. But all the same, and I have this conversation with Shea Mbimbola, who's a Nigerian doctor, researcher, friend, colleague of mine. He's the chief editor of BMJ Global Health. Yeah. Okay, so he's a really good friend of mine. And we just actually chatting last week in his office. He's here at Sydney. And his wife, who's lovely and super brilliant. And I said, okay, well, we say now the conversation is happening, but it's not really, because it's still happening in essay style in the British medical journal, Global Health, but it's British medical journal. So, I mean, once again, anyway, so baby steps maybe, but this policy, global policy, is really very much driven by the North. We do know that very much so. And plays out over and over again when we talked about COVID vaccines, sharing the formula with, who could be manufacturing the vaccines, mm-hmm. Countries that developed their own vaccines, but then there was a real turning of eye. Oh, that, those must not be good enough. Cuba mm-hmm. developed their own, China developed their own, and a real snobbery, I do think, by other countries in terms of the wording, the language used around locally developed innovation. And I think it's unbelievably narrow-minded. And, mm-hmm. One thing I love, but it still has an element of the global north, so it's kind of terrible in its own sense. But, Mohamed Yunus, who wrote the Banker to the Poor book, I'm neither here nor there. I've not read all the reviews about it. I don't mm-hmm. really know what people think about it, but I read it long time ago. One thing I really liked about it was he was a local who went home and listened to women in the village about what their solutions and ideas were to lift them out of poverty and improve health and so on. And that ultimately made its way all the way upwards to concepts of microfinance and World mm-hmm. Bank taking on things. So I think it's just one tiny example of how clearly solutions lie everywhere. And listening is just the best thing that all of us can do with each other. Mm-hmm. And I'm just such a simple mind. I really am. And, I don't know whether I have any impact in this world, I guess. I know I'm not in a power position, but I just, I guess in my small ways, aim to listen and ensure we work as equitably, I guess, together as we can.
Yeah. Well, I think you're a simply amazing person. And I think that in having our conversation, the space you offer for hearing and listening and your openness makes you have a far greater impact than a lot of people around you. So I would say that I think that you're having a pretty significant impact. And I love what you said about just it's the politics of citation too, like who we cite, who we bring in as an academic source, and who is a credible part of evidence making. This is a conversation that I've had with my counterparts too in our global health courses, because when we're talking about, for instance, conversations in the African context, the people who you should be citing realistically are the people who are living there. But it's that we are citing people who are so removed from that experience because they're existing in a certain part of the world, and that is tied to power and privilege, and that stems from history. And histories of saviorism, right? Like if you're looking at how stories are formed, the protagonist, the savior, for there to be a savior and for there to be a protagonist, then there needs to be a perpetual victim. There needs to be someone who is in an indefinite space of crisis that needs to be saved, the savage who doesn't know how to articulate their experience for themselves, right? And I think that unfortunately, as much as academia tries to veer away from that, it perpetuates those same kinds of problematic ideologies just because of how knowledge is produced, who gets to be part of knowledge production, the inherent power structures that we say that we acknowledged, but we don't truly we don't truly acknowledge them unless it serves us. But exactly. So I think that it really does impact, you know, like when you talked about the vaccines that were deemed credible versus the vaccines that weren't. If you're looking at the travel bans that were implemented and who is on the list, and who was allowed to travel, like which bodies were permitted to move in the world were based on and stemmed from unequal knowledge production systems, and hierarchies of evidence making, and who gets to be considered people who are inhabiting that space of objective knowledge production. So I'm looking at the time and I'm loving this conversation, but I will ask you our last question, or our last two questions of the evening my time, but afternoon your time, which is, one is, what brings you joy in your everyday life? And two, and looking at the fact that we're, I wanted to say naturally living in these systems of oppression, but this is an unnatural system that we've created, and I'm trying to be very careful about the language that we use to describe our world systems. So it's not a natural system, it's an intentionally curated system of manufactured vulnerability. But in looking at the system that we're living in, and in recognition of the intersecting crises that we're living in, what is your form of resistance as well? So what brings you joy, and what are your forms of resistance as a way to ease us out of the conversation?
Yes, so interesting. And when you ask about forms of resistance, is that how I resist the systems which are continuing to oppress? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and okay. and I can add a little caveat. It doesn't have to be anything big. It literally could be, oh, I wake up, instead of going on my phone in the morning, I take a walk. So it doesn't have to be anything sort of inherently tied to politics and, you know, protesting and all of that. But your small forms of resistance in your everyday life.
Yeah, it's great. I love that question. I was chatting about it actually with a friend last night. And there's a little bit to this. So I benefited from parents who instilled in me a belief that trust yourself, you're okay, who you are is enough, and you know, be good and be kind, I guess, like really quite simple, but it matters a lot because when I go out in the world, I do feel a real peace with myself. I don't feel the need to prove anything. When someone asked me once at a party, oh, you're a professor. Oh, wow. Are you looking to climb the hierarchy? Like what's next for you? Head of school? And then are you thinking about dean? And I said, and it really just came from my gut reaction was, I almost feel disgusted by the position I'm in because of the way the world views me as having some kind of supremacy over them because of a title or a position, because I don't feel it at all. And I purposely continue to talk in the way that I grew up and don't adopt an academic speak. And I said to that person, and it's true too, because just luckily, I think because of the way I was raised, I don't seek to climb any hierarchies. I have no desire to be powerful. I only seek to make positive change. And I think now through life, I think I've come to realize that my opportunity to make change is probably quite limited. And so my best change is to make that within my home sphere, my local sphere, and potentially the people I come in contact with, and to live the life I believe should be lived in my own circles. And that's a beginning, I guess. And so to those ends too, I don't conform to much at all. And to some degree that could cause some trouble. And it has actually at times, but I, you know, you can't be, I don't conform, but I also don't intend to be evil. So it's not, you know, I just, you know, I might wear running shoes to teach a lecture at the top WHO meeting. I just don't really, it just doesn't matter to me that I think, you know, if you're a good person and you're doing good things, that there are just some structures in our society that are just, they need to be broken down a little bit. Because if, and I was saying this to somebody about fashion, I'm the least fashionable person, but it's funny how it seems to matter. But then if fashion matters to us, then how does somebody feel if they wear a sari in a class where everybody's white and wearing the white gear? Or what if somebody is bald and they have a disability, and how do they feel? So it just, it's that cognitive dissonance that you mentioned earlier, that how can we hold these things at once? So I guess all to say that how I rage against the machine is just staying strong in myself. And I've come around to also realizing that if we can raise children of the world to be comfortable in their own skin, believe in themselves, be who they are, that actually some of these systems of oppression will be minimized, because some of them exist because people feel scared, and they may be truly scared, which is also quite sad because we have scary systems and the scary parts of our world. But if we can create safety, emotional safety, and raise beings to feel comfortable, then that actually also flows out to assist, I guess, in some of these systems. Yeah. just on the simple side, I guess what brings me joy is absolutely being with people, number one, I guess, listening to people where things are happening, I guess. Like I work up now more in the policy space and sometimes with stakeholders, but I try not to do that too much. And actually each day I try to make sure that either I'm shadowing a patient through their day at the hospital, or I'm meeting a family, who's just coming in from like the flooded region of New South Wales in Australia, where they're having a hard time, and we're trying to work on projects with UNICEF to support them. But I really try and just make sure that there's a lot of listening. It's just so important, I guess. And I also try to ensure I'm working on things that have immediate benefit as well as long-term potential, so that every day what I'm doing and how I'm working with people matters a ton. And I really won't bulldoze relationships today with the people who I am with for future project outcomes or anything like that. Living what I believe in, I guess, truly. Yeah. And just simply, I guess, I love nature and I love just running about in it with my kids and my friends and my family.
I love that. I love that. That whole answer is so is so beautiful, especially in talking about just not the idea of nonconformity. There's this quote by this poet named Buddy Wakefield, and he says, "Your expectations of me are not mine to carry; those are yours." And I take that with me wherever I go, because the system, and the way that it reperpetuates itself banks on conformity, and it banks on cultural sheep. It banks on large scale ignorance and a disconnection from self, the other, and to nature. So I love that your answer brings all of those worlds together, but also centers at its core the value of talking to people and actively listening, because I think that especially in this moment of rupture or juncture in our global society, where political divisiveness is so high, we just need more people who are like you, that are not only the glue in different spaces, but also values what people living in certain conditions or certain social contexts have to say, especially if the aim is to not only help, but to create a more inclusive system. And there's no way that you can create an inclusive system without interacting or talking to or hearing what people have to say about, you know, the disparities that they experience when trying to penetrate, you know, healthcare, for example. So listening is such an important thing. I think as a global society, we think that we do a lot of listening, but we actually don't. So just kudos to you and the work that you're doing. And I wanted to just extend a huge thank you from our global health department to you for just you taking the time. This has been a nothing short of a blessing of a conversation. So I'm truly grateful. I feel like I'm coming out having gained not only a connection to another incredible human being, but knowledge to carry with me, and just also gentle reminders as we're moving, especially through academic circles, about, you know, keep raging against the machine and not conforming.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. It's a perfect ending. And next week, or how often you do these podcasts, it shall be you being interviewed, because you have a lot to say in a great brilliance. And I look forward to seeing and hearing and remaining connected to you.
Thank you. I thank you so much for your kind words. They are so grounding in ways that I don't know how to express yet, but thank you so much.
Oh, it's so nice. Human to human, isn't it?
Exactly. It's really just about human. That's why we're all here. We're all just walking each other home, as Ram Dass says.
Oh, what a great line. And so melancholy as well.
But you know what? I just as a book suggestion. Hold on.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know Rebecca Solnit, but it's Hope in the Dark, Untold Histories and Wild Possibilities. But she talks about a radical form of hope in this era of, melancholy and darkness and what feels like abyss, maybe.
I have actually seen that book. I have not read it yet, but I as you're talking about it, I think,
Yeah.
oh yeah, I recognize her last name. Yeah. And you know, there are such uplifting still things. You know, I think I was reading something recently this week about this young gentleman in Australia who's an Afghani first generation. So his mom came from Afghanistan and then in 2021, how he and his mom using like mobile phones from their living room during the pandemic, rescued about 90 Afghani
Oh, wow.
orphans who were truly orphaned, like their parent, they really don't have parents kind of thing. It's not one of these other kinds of orphans, which the world has sadly come to know. Anyway, I just think, oh, there really are ways that anyone can do good in this world, and you don't
Yes.
have to be in any particular position. That actually, if you have a drive and kindness in your heart, and seeing the underground work going on behind the
Yes.
scenes to support Ukraine. Yeah, I'm connected a bit to the Ukraine community here in Australia and in Canada, and just watching the number of people out of the kindness of their heart, whether Ukrainian or not, just working day and night after their jobs end to support, people of Ukraine, but also then like, oppression and dictatorship and just like everything that goes. Anyway, I just think there is a lot of positive also, and
Yes.
yeah, I always like to instill in people to know that there's a lot of opportunity to make good in this world too, and not
Yeah,
feel too depressed.
exactly. It's all just perception, right? It just all depends on where you choose to focus your energy on in the big picture. I think that, gratitude and gratitude is one of those ways where you start to see the infinite beauty of the world in the midst of chaos.
The poem to end.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm aware that you have to
Yeah, I do
go,
need to
but I
go.
mean, I could talk to you for forever. But thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking the time to have a chat, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of the day. And I'm so excited to keep connected with you. Thank
Okay, well, you
you.
have a great sleep. I thank you so much for your time and your volunteering to do this kind of thing. And just honestly, I will walk away from this just thinking, top moment. Take care. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.